Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good evening. This is Robert A. Wilson with Cowboy Wisdom NLI Radio. And tonight we're going to expand your vocabulary and open your mind to pronouncing words in a better way. And tonight's guest is Lori Endicott Thomas, who is, writes adult phonics for us people who have forgotten our phonics. And I want to welcome a very beautiful and talented lady. Welcome to the show, Lori.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it is. And now, you've got a book coming out, but give people what you really do and teach them how to open up their reading abilities better, Lori.
Okay. Well, let me give you a little bit about my background so you understand how I approached this subject and why I wrote about it. I'm not a teacher. I've never been a teacher, but I've never worked within the school system, but I've essentially been teaching remedial writing to the most highly educated people in the United States for the past 20 years. I've been an editor for medical journals and medical publishing and so forth. So I have been correcting the grammar of medical doctors and PhDs and so forth for a long time. So I've had kind of a bird's eye view of some of the problems that we've had in our education system. I mean, if people who've gone through all this expensive and extensive education still can't write, we have a problem. And when I really sat down and analyzed why it is that so many people are bad writers, what is it about bad writers that make people bad writers? What it came down to is that they never learned some basic rules of grammar. So I decided I was going to write this book that explained what these basic rules that people weren't learning in school were, and so that I can explain how to use these rules so that they can become better writers and better thinkers as well, because these rules help clarify how you think. Well, then when I started to do my research for the book, then I realized that the problem I'm dealing with is far bigger than just that they're not teaching grammar, because it starts earlier than that. Because as Rudolf Flesch pointed out back in the 1950s in his book Why Johnny Can't Read, we have a problem with functional illiteracy. We have a problem with people being unable to read. And there are millions of people in the United States who cannot read, even though they grew up here and they went to school here. Now, if you look at the history of this problem, and you look at the problem of illiteracy back in, say, the 19th century, the people who couldn't read in the 19th century had never been to school, or had been to some sort of segregated school or something like that. But the people nowadays who can't read, they've been through school. So when I look back at the problem and I said, well, wait a minute. We had very high rates of literacy. People could read in colonial Massachusetts. And even though the schooling there was, they didn't go to school for that long. And their teachers were mainly women who had little more than a primary school education themselves, but they had a good curriculum. They had a good method of teaching people to read. Now, if you fast forward to the 20th century, you find that we stopped using that method for teaching children to read. We started using a completely different method, and as a result, we started getting epidemics of what were called learning disabilities and dyslexia and so forth. So this was a real problem by the 1920s. And the Rockefellers, they hired this man to go out, this medical doctor, Samuel Orton. They hired him to go out to do some field studies to find out why children were not learning to read. And what they found was the problem was the teaching method. They were teaching, instead of teaching children to sound out the words letter by letter, they were teaching them to recognize whole words as units. And the more whole words as units that people learned, or that the children learned before they learned any phonics instruction, the worse, the higher the rates of dyslexia were. So these epidemics of dyslexia, we've known since the 1920s that this is the result of using a teaching method that doesn't work. And yet we're still using that teaching method. Rudolf Flesch told us in the 50s that this was the problem. This is why Johnny can't read, because nobody ever really taught him how. Nobody taught him the sounds of the letters and how to sound the letters out from left to right. And if you teach people that, then their dyslexia and their reading problems go away. And when he came out with his book, it was a big bestseller in the 50s, it raised a huge stink. And the educational establishment closed ranks, they discredited him, and they just kept on keeping on with what they were doing before, and the problem didn't get solved.
And it's still going very prevalent today. And, you know, as I listened to you speaking there, that happened. You know, I was lucky. I think I was in the last years of phonics being taught in school. And now that I'm starting to see it, because now they really don't teach a curriculum. They just try to get people into the working world. Wouldn't you say, is that what you feel, Lori?
Yes, because, and that's why the title of my book is not trivial. If you take a broad view of the history of education, if you go back to ancient Athens, and you find that the citizens of Athens were expected to provide some sort of education for their sons, and the kind of education that was developed for the sons of Athenian citizens was called the well-rounded education, and the Greek word for well-rounded education gave rise to our word encyclopedia. Now, there were seven subjects in this well-rounded education. There were three verbal arts that were called the trivium, or the Romans later called them the trivium, three courses. And then there were four arts of number that the Romans later called the quadrivium. Now, the three verbal arts were grammar, logic, and rhetoric. Now, grammar is the study of the structure of sentences. It's the study of how words are combined and altered in order to make meaningful sentences. Logic is the study of arguments, which is where you take propositions, which are a particular kind of sentence, and you use them, sentences about things that you know about, and you use that to go to discover new information. So if you know, for example, that the classic example of this is the syllogism, where you say all men are mortal, that's the major premise, and your minor premise is Socrates is a man, and from that you can draw the conclusion that Socrates is mortal. So that was the classic syllogism. So that's, and logic, you can either, that's an example of deduction where you start with something, start with a general rule and you apply to a specific example. Then there's also inductive reasoning where you try to go from your observations and try to derive general rules from that. Now, these are, these disciplines of grammar and logic are extremely important, and the reason that they were considered to be so important in ancient Athens was because they had this method of political decision making called democracy, and all of the adult male citizens of Athens were expected to serve in the demos, which was this assembly where political issues were openly discussed. So people would make decisions by discussing them in public, and they'd come to some sort of consensus for a decision. So these studies of grammar and logic and rhetoric, which is the art of persuasive speech, have always been important, have always been highly valued in a society that has a democratic or republican or representative democracy type of political structure. So, and when you look at a society like ancient Rome, the ancient Romans considered this well-rounded education. They called it the liberal studies, and by liberal they meant the studies appropriate for free men as opposed to slaves. So if you were a wealthy patrician and you had sons, you got your sons a liberal education to prepare them for roles in public life and perhaps to serve in the Senate. On the other hand, you didn't provide that kind of education to your slaves, and you didn't want that kind of education to be provided to the common people. Those people would get training in the mechanical arts or the servile arts that would make them more productive as workers. Now, we still have the same kind of issue now where, yes, we need to have training in the mechanical arts, which would include, you know, which would include even things like medicine or accountancy or things like that, so that in, to enable people to make a living and to make them more productive as workers. But if we're going to have anything remotely like a real democracy, we have to have widespread training in the liberal arts for the general populace. And I think that the what I've seen in just studying the history of education is that these studies of grammar in particular have been specific, have been deliberately suppressed in American education, and I think that's a very dangerous development.
You know, you also say the grammar and stuff like that's been suppressed, but also how do you feel the creative arts themselves, the creativity has been stymied too with the way the system is today, Lori?
I think that's important. I wrote the book to emphasize the importance of training in the trivium. But, I mean, that's the trivium and the humanities, because I want people to understand how important it is to know logic and to know history and so forth, just because they're so political. But also the arts are so important, and I mean, so much of what I understand about the American education system was inspired by novels that I read when I was a kid. One of them was Orwell's 1984, and another one was Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. There are some kinds of ideas that can really only be expressed through some sort of art, creative art, some sort of creative activity like that. And of course, I think music education is tremendously important. One of the projects I have on the back burner is a method of teaching people to play piano by ear.
Really? That sounds quite interesting. But I'm looking at your book, Not Trivial. How did you come up with the Not Trivial as a title?
Well, originally, the trivium was grammar, logic, and rhetoric. And that was part of the liberal arts curriculum that was developed in ancient Athens and then was also highly valued in ancient Rome. And when the church started up with the first universities in Europe in the Middle Ages, they needed to have some sort of curriculum to train young men to become doctors and lawyers and administrators and so on. And they needed to teach them. They needed to teach them to think. So what they did was they resurrected this ancient liberal arts curriculum, the seven liberal arts, the trivium and the quadrivium. So when originally the word trivial meant pertaining to the trivium, so if something were trivial, it would mean that it was something that was so basic to education that any educated person would know it. You wouldn't have to explain it. And if mathematicians still use the word trivial in that sense, if they say, well, that proof is trivial, they mean that they don't have to go through that proof. Any reasonably intelligent, reasonably well-educated person should just be able to prove that on their own. It doesn't need to be explained. So originally the word trivial meant that it should be so obvious to any educated person that it doesn't need to be explained. But through the way that people have been using language, of course, words take on new connotations and so forth. Nowadays, if you say the word trivial, people think it means something that's unimportant. And especially with the game Trivial Pursuit, the answers are all questions are about facts that are relatively, you can get through life without knowing them. So the word trivial came to mean unimportant. But I'm saying that the grammar, logic, and rhetoric are not trivial in the modern sense of the word. I think they're absolutely essential as the basis of education for democracy.
Yeah, but it's also basic for just everyday life, isn't it?
Yes, because so many, and getting along with other people. I think that when I listen to the kinds of political discussions that people have nowadays, or discussions about anything, I see the damage that the lack of this kind of training has, or the kind of damage that this lack of training creates. Now, when Plato and the ancient Greek philosophers and so forth, they had this concept called dialectic, where one person would come up with an idea and they would express their idea, and somebody would come up with some conflicting idea. So the original idea was called the thesis, and the conflicting idea is the antithesis. Now, the people would talk about, they would talk about these two conflicting ideas, and they would give the pros and cons for each one, and through a process that was called dialectic, then they could come up with some sort of synthesis, where they would take information from both points of view and come up with some more satisfying overall explanation. And the best example I can give of this in that people will understand is the particle wave duality from physics. Now, for thousands and thousands of years, people have wondered what light is. What is the nature of light? Some people said, an ancient philosopher said, well, light is like pebbles. They move in straight lines, and it's basically the particle theory of light, that light is like a stream of particles of fire, basically. And other people said, no. Light is like, it was like ripples on the surface of a pond. And physicists went back and forth between these two points of view for several thousand years. And there was evidence to support both points of view. Einstein's discovery of the photoelectric principle, it gave support for the particle view. And other people's, they came up with, the light has wavelength, it has interference patterns and so forth, and that supported the wave point of view. Well, then in 20th century physics, one of the great accomplishments in modern physics was this idea that light has both particle-like properties and wave-like properties, and they came up with a synthesis that includes both.
And that's the synthesis of both. How does that relate to today?
Well, the idea, if you use like a transistor all this modern electronics is based on an understanding of this theory. So much of our modern life is built on an understanding of this theory in ways that unless you studied physics in high school, you would not know. So, but just this idea that when I listen to people discuss any sort of issue nowadays, all too often, I hear people start off with their starting position. They may start off with a thesis, and somebody else starts with an antithesis. But there's almost never any progress toward a synthesis. I mean, people just shout their talking points at each other and insult each other, and it's like evidence and logic never enters into it. They don't listen to what the other person is saying. They just keep hammering away at their starting points, and they don't come to some sort of mutually satisfactory growth of understanding. And I think that the reason that people don't know how to do this is because they've never been taught. And I think the reason they haven't been taught is because they were never taught the liberal arts.
Well, not only the liberal arts, but if we started communicating in that way, would we be so easy to be controlled by everything in life?
Well, the idea, if you have this kind of ability, if you can have this ability to see through bad arguments, and if you know basic facts about history and science and so on and so forth, it's like being vaccinated against propaganda. You become much more resistant to being misled.
Well, see, and that's what the media does. Don't you say the media today just floods us with propaganda they want us to do?
Well, all means of communication are from a point of view. And naturally, people will naturally want to persuade people to view things their way. And sometimes the things that we are told through the media and so forth are deliberately untrue. And sometimes it's just because it's so much from one point of view that you can't get an honest picture just because it's so limited. And for example, as I mentioned in my book about Chomsky and Herman's propaganda model of the media, The media are owned, are they're for-profit enterprises owned by big corporations, and they're not going to present educational messages to the public that undermine their bottom line. I mean, that would be nuts. They're not going to do that.
Wouldn't you say it's up to us, the people, you and me, and the world, to educate ourselves, to take them out of the equation, in a way?
Well, I think we have a responsibility to educate ourselves, and we have a responsibility to educate each other, and we especially have a responsibility to look after the education of children. And education has always, always, always been extremely political. Socrates was executed because of an offense related to education, because of a political dispute over education. So, it's always been a central concern, because education is how you lay the groundwork for what society is going to be like in the future. And if that isn't political, it ought to be.
And, you know, that's the thing. You know, here's something that I've really paid attention to, Lori. All the so-called people that really have a legacy in life are never really recognized until centuries or even thousands of years later. And I'm talking about the Zen, the Buddha, Gandhi, and, you know, people like Socrates. They're not really realized their greatness until another lifetime. Do you see that, or am I looking at that half full or half empty?
Well, it's when I look back at some people who were tremendously influential in their day but are ignored now, some of them deserve to be ignored now, and some people, yeah, I think there's a lot of that.
I mean, Gandhi did more without any violence than any man I've seen, and he got more done by not raising violence, and look what the world is violent, and we're not going anywhere. But do you think the violence of the world is from people not being able to communicate?
When I was talking recently with some teachers who work with autistic children, and the particular children that they were working with had language delays. They were having trouble learning to speak. And they said that it gets so frustrating. And that one of the teachers said, well, you know, what he said to me sort of as a Socratic question or a Socratic method type of question. He says, now, what would you do if you had some sort of burning desire or some sort of burning message that you wanted to express, but you couldn't express it in words? And I said, oh, gee, I don't know. I probably would bite somebody. He rolled up his sleeve, and he showed me this bite mark. So one of his patients, or one of his students had just bitten him. But, I mean, it's people get frustrated, and anger is very is the result of goal frustration. And when people can't express themselves in words, and little kids when they're at the age where they're just starting to learn to speak but they can't really get the words out, that's when they bite people. So I see that same thing in older people where they can't communicate, or they're frustrated because people just won't believe them, or they don't have methods for getting achieving their goals through some sort of productive way, and that's they can't use their words. And when you're trying to break up a fight with little kids or so forth, you try to get them to behave themselves and behave like little gentlemen and little ladies. You say, well, use your words. Well, we don't. The liberal arts, the verbal arts, the trivium is all about how to use your words. So, I think it does help. It provides civilized methods for resolving disputes. And if you look at the dictionary definition of the word civility, now, a lot of people think that civility just means politeness. Civility originally meant training in the liberal arts. So it meant the training that would enable you to make reasonable arguments and to be a reasonable person and to be wise, not just to obey the social niceties and I think one of the big problems that we do have in, politically in the United States is that we've been brought up to think that it's impolite to talk about politics. And people say, oh, well, don't ever talk about politics or religion. It's impolite. And I can only imagine what the Founding Fathers would have thought if somebody had said, oh, well, in this republic that you're founding, it will be considered impolite to talk about politics. They would have been stunned. But unfortunately, because people have just been told that it's impolite, then they think, well, then there's no need to be polite when they talk about politics. So, and that's another reason why the political climate gets and political discussions get, they don't, political discussions don't have to be unproductive and ugly.
You know, but do you think, to me, some of that unproductive and just ugly is so they don't have to do nothing. They keep everybody stirred up. And I want to give out Lori's blog site. It's www.nottrivial.blogspot.com. I'll give that again, www.nottrivial.blogspot.com. And getting back to Not Trivial, when is your book coming out?
Shortly, very soon. I'm getting it. It's being reviewed by a bunch of people who know far more about my subject than I do. So I depend on them to make sure I don't look too stupid in public.
Well, and nobody, you know, anybody that's willing to write a book is never foolish or stupid. They're just very stout-hearted. Because, see, to be successful, there's two keys, stubborn and hard-headedness. You have to be too stubborn to quit and too hard-headed to know when you're beat, and that's two keys to success.
Well, that's true. And I think part of the – you have to have all sorts – you also have to have some sort of independence of mind. And I got mine early because I learned to read before I started school.
I've always had the independence of mind, trust me.
Well, because – so I didn't – I just felt that school was – I mean, it was – I could already read by the time I started school, so I didn't depend on – I didn't depend on the school to teach me how to read. And since I read to learn, I always had that kind of advantage. And I've seen children – just utterly destroyed by having problems learning to read.
And do you think that comes from the parents not knowing how to read?
Well, one of the things I explain in my book is that the schools in relatively wealthy neighborhoods are succeeding. If you look at the test scores, and this is one of the reasons why I'm very, very skeptical of the value of a lot of this over-testing that we're doing. If you have a test, first of all, the test has to be validated. You cannot simultaneously evaluate the test and the results of, and the results of a test. So, I mean, the test itself might be useless. So, so you have to have a good test. But even if you have a good test that shows that whether or not children can read, and you give that test to fourth graders in a school, and you try and you say, oh well, this percentage of the children in the school can read and that percentage can't or whatever. That test, at best, can tell you whether those children learn to read. It cannot tell you where those children learn to read or why those children learn to read. Now, as I said, I learned to read before I started school. And in a lot of relatively affluent communities, If a ineffective teaching method is being used, such as having children memorize whole words at a time instead of sounding them out letter by letter, if that method is being used, and your parents can read, if your parents are educated, they can teach you to read at home, or they can work with you until you catch on one way or the other, or
and
they can hire a tutor because they've got money. But if you've
Go ahead.
School that is in a neighborhood where the population is illiterate and poor, all they have is the school. And if the school is ineffective, those kids are sunk.
And, you know, it is reading, writing, and arithmetic by hand and learning how to do it before a computer are essential, wouldn't you feel?
Well, I think it's important for, I mean, people cannot, they can't read or write cursive writing anymore. And I think that this inability to read cursive writing, I was talking to Don Potter, who's a, or communicating with him by email. He's an expert on phonics and bilingual education, and he's got some really really good stuff on his website, donpotter.net. Well, anyway, when I said about, he said something about kids can't read cursive, and I said, well, of course not. They didn't learn phonics. And when you learn to read by memorizing the shape of whole words, whenever you go to a different typeface, or you know, if it's in all caps, or if it's in a different font, or something like that, or God forbid somebody should write in cursive, the whole shape of the word changes, so it's no longer recognizable. And that's why kids can't read cursive writing, because they weren't taught phonetically.
And Laurie, I'm going to read your website, your blog site one more time: www.nottrivial.blogspot.com. And her book, Not Trivial, will be coming out very shortly.
Yes, it's Freedom of Speech Publishing.
With who?
With Freedom of Speech Publishing. That's the name of the publisher.
And Patrick and Gerard do a good job. They publish my books.
Oh, good, good.
And also, Laurie, give the people some wisdom, and we'll close out the show. And we will have Laurie back, because this is something that will expand the world. Learning how to read.
Okay, well, my parting wisdom is, if you have little kids, or if you have anybody who's having trouble with reading, if there are adults who are poor readers, then find someone who will teach them phonics. And teach them phonics, and it will improve their ability to read English. Second, learn grammar. Learn to diagram a sentence. Because if you don't understand some of the basic principles of grammar, then you cannot go on to study logic. There are some basic principles of grammar you must understand if you're going to study logic. And if you want to be a responsible grown-up person who plays an important role in society, you must learn logic, because it's the discipline of how not to make stupid mistakes when you're thinking. So, I took some logic in school, but there's also books in the library where you can learn a lot about it. There are a lot of things on the internet now, but you know, learn phonics, learn grammar, learn logic. Those are my three pieces of wisdom for today.
And I want to thank Laurie for being here. I want to thank all the listeners, and also want to, Mark Eisenhart will be here Thursday night, and I really want to thank Laurie and all the listeners, and thank you, Laurie.
Thank you very much.
And we'll have Laurie back, and good night, everybody. We'll see you Thursday.